from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
So we've really seen a huge shift in who makes up the media, and I think that that has really resulted in not just what they're covering, but how Americans feel about the media, which is not very good.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Batya Ungar Sargon, deputy opinion editor of Newsweek, and also author of the new book, Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. We'll talk at length with Batya about her new book a little bit later on in today's program. But first, talking now about the launch of the Nimrod Education Center here at Hillsdale College, and joined by three gentlemen. Al Stewart, who's the director of the Nimrod Education Center here at Hillsdale, Alan Taylor, who is the chair of the Nimrod Society, and also we're joined by Bob Radosi, who is a member of the board of directors of the Nimrod Society. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll start with Al first. Al Stewart, who is the director of the Nimrod Education Center. This is a new effort being launched here at Hillsdale College. Tell our listeners a little bit about what this is all about.
Yeah, the Nimrod Education Center is in place here at the college, and our goal, our mission is to help inform the non-hunting public and public overall about the contributions that hunters, anglers, recreational shooters provide to funding conservation in this country, and are really the leaders in why we have had restoration of so many species since, you know, the 1900s.
What's your background, and how do you see your role developing with the Nimrod Education Center?
Well, I've spent over 50 years as a wildlife biologist with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, and recently retired, and was honored to have the college ask me if I was interested in being the director of this program. And so, in essence, I've spent 50 years practicing to get to this point, and I'm excited to be part of the program. And from here on, you know, we're going to engage students, we're going to engage public, it's a national program. So it's really the only one of its type that's attached to a college or a university with this very specific mission. And we're setting out to make a difference in a place that is really needs more communication on what's happening.
Alan Taylor is the chair of the Nimrod Society and co-founder, who is, of course, involved in the Nimrod Education Center here as well. Tell us your story and how the Nimrod Society came to be.
Well, I recognized for quite some time that the general public did not have a firm or clear idea of the involvement and importance of sportsmen here in the country and their role in both protecting and conserving of wildlife, and the general public that just did not have a clear understanding of how wildlife is managed and protected in this country.
And this effort with Hillsdale to create and launch the Nimrod Education Center, why Hillsdale College, and how do you see this education center operating here on campus and then radiating across the country?
Well, Hillsdale is an education center, and we're in the education business, so it was a natural partnership because Hillsdale has association with the shooting sports community. And, of course, conservationists, a big portion of it is with shooting sports, but it also includes fishermen. They showed an interest in it, in participating in further education of their students that eventually will disseminate across the country and continue with the message and support conservation through consumptive sportsman efforts.
You mentioned, you know, the importance of public awareness when it comes to wildlife management, when it comes to conservation. What is this effort trying to counter? Why is there a need for this in the country?
Well, we've known for a long time that there are people that don't understand conservation can be supported by consumptive use of wildlife. And those people are out actively attempting to educate the public as to their views, which I believe are misguided. They don't have an understanding of wildlife protection and conservation. So this is our effort to tell the other side of the story.
Bob Berdosi is also with us, member of the board of directors for the Nimrod Society. And Bob, this is an opportunity for outreach with people hearing it across the country. If you could, you know, bullet point, what are the most important things that the Nimrod Society wants the public to know about these wildlife management conservation efforts, the model that sort of the Nimrod Society wants to work on?
Okay, there you go. That's a challenge. Well, as far as it, we've touched on them and try to make them specific. I think one of the most important things is just making sure the public has actual factual data, real honest data, not emotionally slanted data mm-hmm. or tainted data about the wildlife resources that we have. That's important. So that they have an appreciation. Everyone likes wildlife, but they don't necessarily have real facts about it. And those facts get slanted sometimes for political reasons and such. But so making sure that they have factual information on a regular basis. I think another point would be to what we found out is a lot of people don't realize one of the weaknesses is that most people don't know how wildlife management is funded.
Mm-hmm.
We discovered that early on. And many actual hunters and anglers don't even realize that the majority of wildlife management is funded through the license dollars that sportsmen spend, as well as, you know, other funds through Pittman Roberts and things like that. So educating the public about where the funding comes from. The average public believes that their tax money actually mm-hmm. funds for wildlife management. So it's mostly, I think it's just a continued outreach. We hope that with this evolution of the Nimrod Education Center, you were talking about, you know, where do we go? That's, I think, probably one of the challenges for the program is what else can we do? We've got a couple models of state wildlife councils for communication, but, you know, what else might be possible?
Let's swing back over here to Al Stewart to sort of wrap things up here. Al's the director of the Nimrod Education Center here at Hillsdale College. Part of this has to do with the John Halter Shooting Sports Center that Hillsdale College has on campus and this partnership that Hillsdale has with USA Shooting as well. How does that work into the equation?
Every time you fire a shotgun shell, part of the revenue from that goes into wildlife conservation. And so without shooting, you wouldn't have conservation, and without conservation, you wouldn't have wildlife. And that's really, you know, a direct lead. Hillsdale College is very special because of the Halter Shooting Facility, but USA Olympic Shooting saw the uniqueness of this college and moved their home site for all USA Shooting here.
Hmm.
That spinoff then is many of these Olympic shooters or hunters mm-hmm. or anglers. And what better individuals to have than these folks that represent our country to share this message that hunting and fishing is a legitimate use of the resources. And all of that goes into then to managing the wildlife
mm-hmm.
that we all appreciate as part of our personal quality of life. That's what this is all about.
Yep.
And Hillsdale College and the Nimrod Education Center right now is right in the middle of that. And, you know, as Bob and Al said, we're going to help share this message and network throughout the country on making sure people understand how conservation is funded.
Well, we look forward to seeing the Nimrod Education Center launch and grow. Al Stewart, director of the Nimrod Education Center, Alan Taylor, chairman of the Nimrod Society, and Bob Berdosi, member of the board at the Nimrod Society. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we talk with Batya Ungar Sargon. Her new book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Find out more about Hillsdale College at hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Batya Ungar-Sargon, and her new book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Her day job, you find her at Newsweek, where she is Deputy Opinion Editor. Batya, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why, explain to our listeners, why is journalism referred to as the fourth estate? And why, and this goes back to our founding fathers, of course, why is journalism so important for a democracy?
Wow, what great questions. The fourth estate was in reference to the other estates back in Europe in the day. So you had the priestly estate, which was the first estate, the noble estate was the second estate, and the third estate was the middle class. And then it was very, very important that there be a separate form of expression, expertise, authority to reflect upon the other forms of authority in the republic. That was considered to be a really important way of giving power to the people, that there was an independent source of authority that could explain to them what was happening in the other sources of authority, how power was being wielded by those who had it, so that they could then make up their minds and have a modicum of power through that knowledge. And so we can see why that's really, really important, right? You can look around yourself at your local government and think about what they would get up to if there was nobody reflecting on them, right? What people in power could do when there's no countervailing force to their authority that's informed by the facts in an independent way, right?
Mm-hmm. Your third chapter, A Status Revolution, begins by saying, even up until very recently, journalists were not part of the American elite. I would imagine most Americans now look at journalists, certainly those who cover our national politics, as being part of the elite. How did journalism start in this country? How did it transform into something that is controlled by the elite, by and large?
So they're not wrong when people look around at the American journalists and think that they are part of the elite. They, in fact, are now part of the elite. Just from a purely economic point of view, journalists are now part of the top 10% in terms of income. But that actually took a lot of time. There was a status revolution among journalists that landed them there, and that status revolution took about 100 years. And what happened with that status revolution was journalists became increasingly highly educated, and the highly educated in America, we've seen over the last 20 years especially, how the economy today is really very heavily weighted in the favor of people who have a very, very elite degree, a very elite education. And so journalists today now are much more highly educated than the average American. They make a lot more money. They're much more coastal. 75% of all journalism jobs are on the coast. Another survey from 2017 found that the majority of journalists didn't just live in, you know, Clinton districts and in blue areas that went for Clinton, but they lived in the most pro-Clinton districts, right? So we've really seen a huge shift in who makes up the media. And I think that that has really resulted in not just what they're covering, but how Americans feel about the media, which is not very good.
Talking with Batya Ungar-Sargon, her new book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. It's impossible to underplay the role that the Internet has played on journalism. In some ways, did it break journalism when we look at some of the more elite establishments, read New York Times, Washington Post, etc., but also save journalism because of what independent writers and reporters now have access to and can do by themselves on the Internet? Did it both break and save journalism at the same time?
I mean, what a great question. It even saved, right, the New York Times, right? Like,
yes,
the places that
right.
We criticize for having lost their way because of the way that they responded to the digital pressures are also doing extremely well, right? Of course, thanks to digital journalism, thanks to Donald Trump, thanks to a host of factors, right? But yes, I could not agree with you more. You know, I think that when the Internet first came around, we all sort of imagined it would be this great democratizing force, right? It now essentially costs zero money to start a publication, right? So what could be more democratizing than that? But what happened was you have all of these legacy media outlets which have been leaning into both the pressures but also the opportunities of digital journalism. And what they have done with that is really lean into a very affluent, highly educated liberal audience, as opposed to doing what, you know, Benjamin Dan Joseph Pulitzer did, which is say, you know, oh, wow, you know, we can do this for so much cheaper. Let's try to cater to a mass audience. And the reason that happened was because with digital media, and I can tell you this as somebody who works in it, you can track everything, okay? Hmm. You know who is reading your piece. You know where they live. You know how much money they make. You know what they bought yesterday and what they're going to buy tomorrow. You know what their political preferences are. You know what they like to eat. You know how long they stay on the page. You know what words make them click.
Right.
Right? This is, all of this information has been a boon for publications because now what they can do is say, oh, I can limit my audience by covering this topic and that topic to only, you know, very, very affluent, highly educated people.
Talking with Batya Ungar-Sargon, her new book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. I wanted to ask about woke media. I think most of our listeners have a pretty decent understanding of what you mean when you use that term. But why is it a danger? Why is it not just bad journalism? Why is it not just bad media? Why is it a problem for the country? And as you say in the title, why is it undermining democracy?
I argue in my book that journalists, as they underwent this status revolution and ascended to the American elite, that they abandoned the working class, they abandoned labor, they abandoned the sort of the masses who this nation is sort of built on, whose labor this nation is built on, who have been increasingly abandoned by both parties. And I argue that this is hugely problematic and hugely dangerous to our democracy. Journalists are using a moral panic around race to hide a huge class divide in America that's separating out people with a college education from people who don't have a college education. And at a time when the economy is really working very, very well for highly educated people and very, very poorly for people who don't have a college education.
The moral panic chapter, Batya, is it a problem that so many issues these days become nationalized? There is very little that remains local, and that sort of feeds into the social media hive. That's something that happens in Podunk, Missouri, isn't just an issue for that town anymore. It now becomes a national outrage. Is that healthy?
Oh, I think it's terrible. I mean, I have to admit something to you, but, you know, it's a funny thing for a journalist to admit, but I think people are reading too much journalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are too invested in the minutia of national politics. You know, the last 3 months, the Democrats have been negotiating their Build Back Better bill, right? This bill is going to pass in some form or another. Why does the entire nation have to be in on every single day? Who is the villain of today? Mm-hmm. What did Sanders get? What did Pramila Jayapal say? What did cinema do? Who cares? You know, like, it's just, we've replaced spirituality and community with information and politics and knowledge that's totally nationalized and totally divorced from our lives. And it's not like the media is covering important things. Like, you know, there's like a huge, huge revolution of workers underway right now that you cannot read about in any media outlet. Workers are standing up for themselves, demanding better wages. They are demanding better pay. They're demanding better benefits. A lot of them don't want the vaccine, you know, like nobody is speaking up for these people. Nobody is representing them. Nothing that actually matters to our lives is being filtered through the media. But the agenda is being set because of this disproportionate amount of attention that we give to it.
Batya Ungar-Sargon, her new book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Batya, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, we're joined by Elizabeth Fredericks from Hillsdale's English Department as we begin an occasional series on modern Irish poetry. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Hi, this is Billy Pilgrim from my buddy Doug Tooley from B&T 241-3474. You need to know that number, 241-3474, for the best service. Doug and his great crew at B&T makes TV so easy. They're the experts. They do TV wall mounts. They did one for us. TV antennas, surround sound. They can even set up your RV or set up your boat. Doug doesn't do dishes, but he'll dust behind your TV. So for all your TV entertainment needs, no matter what it is, call the local guys. Call my buddy Doug Tooley, the nicest man in the world, at 241-3474. 241-3474. They'll be there on time. They'll get the job done on time, and you're good to go.
With over 60 years of combined experience, let us, your locally owned TV guys, help you. We know what we are doing. You can trust us. Call me, Doug Tooley, 241-DISH. That's 241-3474.
Doug makes TV easy.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns, and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260. Or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Hi, this is Matt with Liberty Unabashed, a show on every other Sunday, 8 to 9. Are you awake? Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you realize you're in an information war where we're losing our country? It's time to stand up and defend your freedoms, my brothers and sisters. Americans don't care what color you are. Those of the past do.
Years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Building on our foundational promise to educate ministers and missionaries, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks, Assistant Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Fredericks, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We are excited to start a series with you today that will continue over the next couple of months. And we'll title this Modern Irish Poetry. And we'll begin with an introduction and look at some specific authors along the way as well. What separates Irish poetry from English poetry or any other European poetry for that matter?
Yeah, so there's a few elements. And, of course, the Irish tradition is often sometimes lumped in with the English tradition because it's all English language poetry. But understandably, Irish writers feel a strong tension about this and are often like very conscious of differentiating themselves from the English tradition. But there are a few things that are really striking about Irish poetry in general in relation to English poetry. One is that Irish poetry remains overall very strongly formal, using both clear stanzaic structures and also rhyme, although they do tend to use rhyme with a pretty light, deft touch. If you read, for instance, Irish poetry that's come out just recently, you may not notice the rhyme really strongly on first reading. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of slant rhyme, inexact rhyme, to lend it sort of a still more very conversational feel. And yet when you dig into it, it is very structured, a sort of careful formality to the poetry. Scholar Matthew Campbell has described it as a poetic scene that operates outside the Anglo-American experimental conservative neo-modernist formalist turf wars. And just, I mean, while there is some investment in that, by and large, Irish poets love form and love rhyme and mm-hmm. often stick to that. They'll also use sometimes very difficult poetic forms as well. most famously, Leontia Flynn, who's a young Irish poet, or kind of mid-career Irish poet, in her elegy for Seamus Heaney, used an 11-line form, which is, I mean, as she said, very challenging. At one point, I remember her talking about the poem and saying she wasn't sure what she was thinking when she did it. But then she did it and she was stuck with it, so she had to keep going. And it's a fantastic piece. I mean, a wonderful way of showing respect to authors who've come before, which I think is part of the attraction. It's a way of sort of standing yourself in a tradition. And also finding ways, especially when dealing with difficult subjects, to impose order upon them, or to offer a sense of partial closure to things that are still open-ended and ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of Irish poets do feel a strong sense of European identity as opposed to feeling close to British identity. Ireland is still part of the EU, and that's to them very important. Alternately, some Irish poets have really strong ties to America, and so that can also be a kind of counter-influence to the British influence.
You gave us a few names there in that introduction. Who would you say are the prominent Irish poets that perhaps people may know? Perhaps we'll discuss some of them later on in this series. But who are the prominent names we should know from this from modern Irish poetry?
Yeah, so W.B. Yeats, of course, is always the giant that sort of hovers over everything else and is probably the one that people are most familiar with because he is just hugely popular and extremely good, obviously. But there's a variety of others. Before Yeats, for instance, you have the poet Thomas More, who was the friend and biographer of Lord Byron. He's also the one we can blame for the fact that we don't have Byron's autobiography. He burned it after Byron's death. But he was hugely popular in the 19th century because he wrote the poems of Irish melodies, which get referenced in a number of 19th century novels. These were poems that were set to music, and kind of written to be set to music. Moore himself was not a composer, so he mostly used popular tunes or let people pick their own tunes to play them to, but they were meant to be sung. James Clarence Mangan is another vital 19th century voice who translated a lot of early bardic poetry from Ireland and kind of wrote in that bardic style. It's a very lofty, non-sentimental mode in contrast to Moore, who is very sentimental. Moving past Yeats on the other side, or overlapping with him a bit, you have Austin Clarke, who was a prominent Dublin poet, and also Patrick Kavanagh, who are both significant writers. Kavanagh especially, while he isn't very well known stateside at times, he's one of the most beloved poets in Ireland. And the Irish Times released a list of the favorite Irish poems, 100 favorite Irish poems. And it was really Kavanagh and Yeats dueling it for the most poems on the list, with Seamus Heaney probably in third.
Talking with Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks about modern Irish poetry. So we know some of the names. How would you describe some of the more prominent themes of modern Irish poetry?
Yeah, this can vary over time in terms of which ones sort of ebb and flow, especially as people are resisting to what they might see as caricatures of Irish culture in sort of the international light. But Irish poetry may, especially in the 19th and early 20th century, draw from the region's really rich folklore and mythic traditions. This includes just folklore that's sort of oral tales, stories of the fairies, popular ballads, myths and superstitions, but also the four great cycles of Irish mythology, which are known as the mythological cycle, the Ulster cycle, the Fenian cycle, and the historical cycle. And a lot of stories we do know of, say, like Cuchulainn or famous people like that, come from these mythic cycles. And even now, authors still will play with them. Kieran Carson, towards the end of his poetic career, famously translated one of the episodes from this called The Tan, which is a big story about a cattle raid, essentially, but with mythic warriors and famous queens instead of just local robbers. So that's often some of it. You may also get treatments of the tragic love story of Deirdre and Naoise, which is a really popular one, too. Also, Ireland has a really strong tradition of classical influences that predates both the Norman and the Tudor conquests, so there's a tendency to draw from Greek and Roman poets and playwrights as well. The Irish really see that as being part of their history and not something that was foisted on them by outside sources.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes in the effort to resist English influence, the classical tradition is something to turn to. Homer, Virgil, and often they really love the Greek tragedies as well.
Final question here for Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks on modern Irish poetry. Tell us a bit about the Celtic Revival and its influence on Irish poetry.
Yeah, so the Celtic Revival is really a mix of movements that begins in the 19th century. We often think most of the literary movement because that gives us people like Yeats and his sort of contemporaries that we see there. But more broadly, the mix of movements sought to reinvigorate interest in a sort of pre-conquest Irish culture. And so as a result, it was about the revival of the Irish language, which the English had done their best to sort of try and stamp out.
Mm-hmm.
Also, reinvigoration of interest in Irish sports, which has led to the fact that, that Gaelic football is now really, really popular in Ireland. If you've never seen a Gaelic football match, it's really fun to watch, actually. Sort of all the most exciting things about soccer, football, rugby, and even a little touch of, like, basketball at all seems at times. It's wild and really, really entertaining. So there's interest in all of this, and fresh interest in sort of Irish peasant life as well, because that's sometimes seen as the most authentic version of Irish life, Irish mythology, things like that. Even Irish visual art from that time sort of reinvigorates the visual culture of Ireland. And so all of these things sort of begin in the 19th century, carry forward in the 20th century. And what this tends to mean for our understanding is a revival of interest in Irish subject matter in literature.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeats is often seen as our most visible figure who engages in that. But a lot of his engagement with this also rests on his association with Lady Gregory, who is a widowed aristocrat who lives kind of in the west of Ireland. Her estates are there. And she develops an interest in learning Irish. Even though she herself is of a Protestant background, she starts learning Irish and going around her estate and collecting folklore and fairy tales from the people who live there and sort of codifying them, because she thinks there's something really fascinating there that's worth preserving, worth capturing, and also especially worth disseminating.
Mm-hmm.
And she and Yeats have a really, really fruitful collaboration pretty much until her death. She remains a vital friend for him. And so for Yeats, we see this in his work, in his use of fairy tales and Irish folklore themes throughout, especially his first three books of poetry. It's also an effort of pushing back against caricatures of the Irish in British culture of the time. The Paddy is kind of a stereotypical comic figure in Irish, in British theater and in British literature, the sort of drunken, sentimental fool of a character. And so the Irish literary revival is pointing out that Ireland has this rich culture. And they aren't just a bunch of sentimental drinkers, but they're people with stories and songs, and they aren't just, they are capable of great art, not just sort of disposable culture.
Hmm. Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks, as we begin our series on modern Irish poetry, the next time we talk, we will talk about Yeats. Dr. Fredericks, Assistant Professor of English at Hillsdale College, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so much.
Up next, an alumni spotlight. We talk with Howard Smith from the Hillsdale Class of 1968, honored at our 2021 Alumni Awards Banquet as a distinguished alumnus. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Where do you go in Shasta County to get advice on the best type of firearm to meet your needs and how to safely carry and use it? The answer is to join the revolution at locally owned Bastiani Arms. Bastiani Arms believes in a better way to serve their customers and providing them with all the information needed to make the right decisions before and after the sale. They have a large selection of guns and ammunition and always special discounts for veterans. Self-protection is your right. Join the revolution at Bastiani Arms, 2539 Larkspur Lane in Reading, 222-8222.
Fall savings are underway at Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Eureka Way and Market Street in downtown Reading. Maximize your car wash savings with car washes starting at only $9. A clean car is essential to the value and even safety of a vehicle. And at Quick and Clean Car Wash, they have a variety of car wash packages to choose from. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Eureka Way and Market Street next to Dutch Bros in downtown Reading. Quick and clean.
Hi, this is Dr. Patricia Bay, and my radio show, Therapy in a Nutshell, which airs on Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KCNR, 1460 a.m., or 96.5 FM, is a great show for you to listen to and learn how to effectively change your life. We talk about issues such as communication and trust, couples issues, and many more. Also, you can listen to the radio show on my podcast through the Anchor app, which is free and safe. Or you can tune into the iTunes or Spotify podcast and listen to it there. It's a nice show that'll help you throughout the day and throughout your life. So join me for Therapy in a Nutshell, Saturdays, 11 a.m. at KCNR Radio. This is Dr. Patricia Bay, trying to heal the world 1 hour at a time.
You get me every time.
30 years ago, Simpson University arrived in Reading with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We say hello to our new listeners on AM 1320, FM 101.3 WKAN in Kankakee, Illinois. Thanks for listening to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined now by Howard Smith. He's a 1968 graduate of Hillsdale College, also CEO and owner at Wilson Bohannon Lock Company in Marion, Ohio, and being honored at the 2021 Alumni Awards Banquet here at Hillsdale as a distinguished alumnus. Howard, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're back here on campus. You had mentioned off-air you were here for your 50th, but it's been a couple of years. What are your feelings as you come back to Hillsdale College's campus?
Didn't look like this when I was here, you know, 50-plus years ago, for sure. I mean, we had a student hut on Hillsdale Street. It was right beside Mock. And then while I was here, they built the student center, which is just where you are right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's impressive. I mean, Hillsdale grows in everybody's mind, starting with the Imprimis, you know, that goes back so many years to where it's almost 5 million people subscribe free of charge to the Imprimis. Hillsdale just grows and grows and grows and is more impressive as time goes on. And as I travel business-wise around the country and I tell people I'm a graduate, golly, I have never met a graduate, but I think so much of Hillsdale College. I get the Imprimis. I love what they stand for. They're defender of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the religious freedoms in our country. And we realize 1844 mm-hmm. and what it was, the principles and inclusion of women and all sorts of minorities, all the things that Hillsdale stood for, it's even more important in our country today.
So tell us a bit about Wilson Bohannon Lock Company. I had read that it is now in its seventh generation at the company. What do you do, and what makes Wilson Bohannon unique?
Well, we started out in 1860 in Brooklyn, New York. My wife's great-great-grandfather, my wife was also a graduate. We met the third week in college, and we graduated together. She went on and got her master's at Ohio State, and I went on and spent 4 years in the United States Coast Guard. But going back, 1860, her great-great-grandfather and his son, Todd Wilson Bohannon, founded the padlock manufacturing company in his backyard in a shed behind his house. 1870, they built their first building. 1884, I mean, they started to have another facility with a foundry, and basically they sold to the railroads. There were many lock manufacturers back then. We are now in the seventh generation. We moved to Marion, Ohio. My wife's grandfather moved it there in 1926, and that's almost 100 years. We're about a 70-employee facility. We have all 10 acres of our original industrial park. We were 1 acre back in 1926. We now own all 10 acres. 4 buildings and about 70 employees, about 40,000-square-foot facility, and we make brass-keyed padlocks. So if you want to find out about us, you know, we just go to padlocks.com.
The company has survived for quite a long time through good times and bad times. What have you learned in your time at Wilson Bohannon about being successful when perhaps others are struggling?
I think it's easy for anyone to realize that when times are good, everyone is successful. It's when times are tough that's the challenge. How do you face that adversity? We have a steel workers is our union we have. Came in 1968. I started working at Wilson Bohannon in 1973, and I've been there almost 50 years. I've been the first star in the accounting department, and then the last 25 years as the CEO, president of the company. So, and times get tough. In the recession of 08 and 2000, price of material goes sky high. Through efficiencies and productivity improvements, we remained
competitive. We compete with products made over overseas in China and Mexico. So automation, productivity improvements, and then having a good respect for each other. And two most important words I believe in business today is communication, letting everybody know your visions and your aspirations, keeping everybody on the same page, all the arrows pointing in the same direction, and also love, respect for each other. Our top five officers at our company have over 180 years experience at Wolfson Bohannon Company. So we have loyalty, we have good workforce, we embrace high-end technology, and as our competitors slowly go by the wayside, there's only a few lock manufacturers left in America, and we're proud to be 100% American-made.
Howard Smith is with us, CEO, owner of Wilson Bohannon Lock Company, and distinguished alumni at this year's 2021 Alumni Awards Banquet here at Hillsdale. How do you go about building a culture of employees who are happy to be there, who want to contribute to the success of the company?
You teach each person with respect and dignity. You should have love in your heart. You follow the Christian tenets, as Hillsdale College taught me many years ago, and you work together. As I said, communication is the most important word, I think, in business today. And we just work as a team. We work as a consensus. We believe in each other. We all try to do what we possibly can to make the company successful. And we embrace technology. We're high-end. And we have some of the finest lock machines in the world. And we just I embrace technology. I love technology, automation, robots. We just did a cyber audit through Columbus State. And they said they had never seen a company of 70 employees have as much technology, have as much cybersecurity wrapped inside their four walls as we do. So there's a reason why we've been successful, and it's because we continue to pour money back into our facility. Instead of a lot of families, that usually don't make it past the first or second generation, the third generation says, I'm just going to take the money and run. We've always plowed our money back into our facility and into our employees. We pay good wages, and we honor all the people that work for us.
Wilson Bohannon is located in Marion, Ohio, about 40 miles north of Columbus. It's not quite as remote as Hillsdale, but it's not part of a major metropolitan area. Is there something to that, and why have you stayed in Marion for these years?
We started in Brooklyn, New York in 1860. Started with the railroads. Turn of the century, the railroads started to consolidate. Today, there's only five major railroads left in this country. So we wanted to go. We embraced the turn of the century, and we looked at what our business we sold to were utilities and heavy industry. So we moved to Marion to be more centrally located. Most of America was basically based between the Mississippi and the East Coast. Okay, so Marion was a railroad hub. So a gentleman, Mr. Huber, came to Marion in the 1870s and built quite an industry. And then Marion Power Shovel, he was one of the founders of Marion Power Shovel. So Marion is considered a double diamond. So that's how we move product. We wanted to be centrally located, closer to utilities and heavy industry. And there was a Melba Casting Company in Marion. And so for those reasons, then my wife's grandfather, Wilson Mahanan Choi, came through on a troop train in World War I, stopped at a whistle stop there, canteen stop, and he remembered the friendliness of the people in Marion. So in 26, when he was looking to move, he thought about Marion. There's where we stayed since 1926, one location.
Let's talk a bit about your time here at Hillsdale, class of 1968. What did Hillsdale teach you about being a responsible citizen, and how have you applied those lessons perhaps with Wilson Bohannon?
I believe in giving back. I believe in the community commitment. Hillsdale, just all the things they stand for, the religious freedoms, the conservative values, the defending of the Constitution, and all those things I believe in, and I honor those, and I embrace them today. So Hillsdale gave me all the basic tools to be a business person today with honor and respect. So Hillsdale just continues to impress everyone across this country. So all those things that I learned here, I applied many more times from my experience at Hillsdale. I mean, just the socializing, being part of something, being part of the union policy board, and things like that, and the leadership workshop program. There were so many opportunities at Hillsdale presented themselves to me. So I took advantage of all those things and enjoyed them. So many of those things I incorporated in my life and also in my business world. Mm-hmm. And Hillsdale, the imprimis that reaches over 5 million people, business people I talk to all across America are very, very impressed with Hillsdale. Look around how this campus has grown and how your $1 billion you apply to students where 90-some% of your students get some form of aid. You know, other universities, the Yales, the Harvards, that have $40 or $50 billion, do they share that with their students? Certainly Hillsdale does.
Howard Smith, Hillsdale College, class of 1968, CEO, owner of Wilson Bohannon Lock Company, out of Marion, Ohio, and that website, one more time, is?
Padlocks.com. Anywhere in the world you want to find about a padlock, is padlocks.com. And or if you want to buy Made in America, you'll go and you'll see us.
Howard, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so very much.
That will do it for this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Al Stewart and Alan Taylor telling us about the Nimrod Center here at Hillsdale College. Batya Ungar Sargon, her new book is called Bad News. Elizabeth Fredericks talked to us about modern Irish poetry. And we heard from honored Hillsdale alumnus Howard Smith. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews, including Batya Ungar Sargon this week, or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or find us on Facebook. The assistant producer of the show is Nate Esbenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Seco Manufacturing Company presents How People Make Things at Turtle Bay now through January 9th. Explore this new and interactive exhibit where kids can learn firsthand about the tools and processes used to make objects that we see and use every day. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
A building that's meant to last is not built overnight. And for centuries, the cornerstone has been crucial to guide each brick and wall that comes after. A strong community relies on many cornerstones. So at Cornerstone Community Bank, we've taken our name to heart. Whether it's your business or your family, we'll provide the financial cornerstone that you need to build on. We're local. We're community. We're your cornerstone. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Hi, I'm Rob Burrows from the Northern California Veterans Museum and Homeward Bound Military Family Support Services. I want to invite you to our annual packages for the troops December 4th. Join us from 1 to 6 p.m. at the VFW Hall in Anderson on Center Street. $10 for adults, $8 for students with ID. Children 12 and under are free. Admission covers costs for lunch and partial shipping for a box. And hey, while you're out there buying Halloween candy, buy an extra bag for the troops. You can drop donations off every Friday between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. at the museum offices located at 2110 North Street in Anderson. Or bring it to the event December 4th. Again, this year I want to remind you, Homeward Bound is providing Thanksgiving and Christmas meals for military families in need during these holidays. You can donate canned goods, hams, or turkeys, or gift cards. Again, drop-off for your donation is every Friday between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. at the museum offices on North Street. For more information, call Rob Burrows at 530-510-8210. And thank you for your support.
Make this New Year's Eve a night to remember at the Redding Garden of Life. Featuring two stages of live music, food trucks and bars throughout the gardens provided by Mosaic, all surrounded by a magnificent holiday light show. Tickets available at turtlebay.org.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wing Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill we all have to pay?
time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
When a unicorn is slain, men have destroyed again the image of beauty that they seek. Nicholas Stewart Gray.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
October is our favorite month because we both really like Halloween. So for this October, we decided to take on the topic of monsters, creatures, things that go bump in the night.
We have been fairly academic over the summer and much of the spring. We wanted to have a little fun with this series. So we are starting with the brightest monsters that we can think of, the wholesome, the good ones. And then we are ending with the darkest monsters of all, the scary ones. As we get closer to Halloween, we're going to have more and more fun in this regard.
Yes. So let's get into today's topic. Monsters associated with good, with light, with purity. Because monsters aren't all evil, dangerous, and out to kill us. The definition of monster is usually just kind of an unusual creature outside of the norm.
Something that's been affected by magic in some way.
And unicorns fit that definition. The oldest reference was in the 4th century AD by a Greek physician. I don't even want to try to say his name. But that physician described unicorns as a wild ass as large as a horse with a white body, a red head, and dark blue eyes. The horn was about a foot and a half long, and it was red, white, and black. There really isn't any modern description of a unicorn that fits this.
I think when it started getting associated with purity, that was when all things that were good and wholesome were also associated with the color white in Europe, versus evil was dark and black. So I think they moved it toward the white. So our traditional image of a unicorn now is closer to all white, somewhat sparkly.
That description came around in about the 12th century AD. That's when they tried to bring the mythological lore of Greek and Roman beliefs into Christianity. Here's the weird thing, though. They, at that time in the 12th century, were described about the size of a goat. So small, little things, instead of a wild ass as large as a horse.
And along with that image of purity was that a unicorn would only come to a chaste virgin.
A lot of these themes are in the old movie Legend that has Tom Cruise, Tim Curry, and a couple of unicorns. Weird show. But it has that kind of theme to it of unicorns are associated with sexual purity.
I mentioned the horn being sort of not only what makes a unicorn unique and sort of by definition a unicorn, but that also tends to be where a lot of the magic is held in this magical creature. And it turns out that they actually bought and sold unicorn horns at one point during medieval Renaissance time.
They were used a lot in the medieval times in alchemical pursuits as a way to cure poison, to identify poison. At least that's their belief. But what were these unicorn horns? In reality?
Narwhal horns. It turns out they thought that the Vikings were particularly good at hunting unicorns because they came up with all sorts of unicorn horns. And to give you an idea of how much a horn was worth in that time period, there are records of people trading an entire castle for a unicorn horn. So the Vikings are like, narwhal horns.
They kind of look like unicorn horns.
Lop them off, bring them down. Hey guys, can I have a castle? And they did this, not once, not twice, but for 5 centuries.
Yeah, so great. So Queen Elizabeth in the 1570s had a unicorn horn. She drank out of a unicorn horn cup, and it was actually a narwhal horn. I love the history of unicorns. But it's not just in Western culture that a unicorn-type creature is associated with purity. A lot of Asian cultures have a creature similar to the unicorn. It's often called the Asian unicorn or the Chinese unicorn. But
the news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.